Welcome to Better Read, an experiment by Greg.org to transform art-related texts into handy, entertaining, and informative audio. This interview with male artist Ray Johnson was conducted by Savim Fazci for the Oral Histories Project of the Archives of American Art on April 17, 1968. I believe it took place in Locust Valley, New York. Savim Fazci, I'd like to start with where you were born. I mean by that your birthplace, your family and religious background, and were your parents artists themselves? You know, just a few words about it. Ray Johnson, yes. Well, I find whenever one begins a tape like this that it doesn't get interesting until you're into it. Yes, it's always like that. And your beginning questions prompt a certain silence. I mean, thinking of one's childhood as a tape, if one is born and begins to live the way this tape begins, things go very slowly. And in public libraries which I used to find myself in, the different kinds of books are in different sections. If you want biography to be, I'm interested in these things that work like tape machines and places like drugstores. I saw a marvelous movie last night that cost 5 cents. That cost 5 cents, you mean? Yes, you put a nickel into it. It's an old Nickelodeon. You look into it, and you're able to control the speed. I can go very slowly or very fast. You can make it stop and you can sort of go at it at your own rate of interest. So, in a certain way, my childhood was like that. Many years later, I was just interested in asking you these questions because I remember that the last time I saw you, you told me that you were from Finland, I think. No, my grandparents were from Finland. I was born in Michigan. I'm very much American. I see. And when did you come to New York? I'm inclined to think I'm not here. You're not here? In which way do you mean? No, you're pursuing a question and answer kind of way and, well, I mean, oh. Machine turned off. Savim Fazci, okay. Ray Johnson. I was saying that I'm not really very interested. Maybe it's just this time of day that I'm not at all interested in my childhood. I don't have any ideas about it or my ancestry. When I came to New York is of no interest to me because of my ideas of time and space. I think if I said 1912 or 1921, it doesn't really make any difference except for the fool who is going to start dissecting what the truth is, you know, exactly what year it was. I don't know whether you can do that. I understand. But a question I would like to ask you is when you began to be really interested in art yourself? What year? Was it very early, when you were very young, that you wanted always to express yourself through different media? I don't think there's any answer to the question. No? I can't understand. But it's entirely up to you what you want to say. But if we talk of the creative process involved in your work, can you tell me a little bit about how you proceed in the creation of a new work? Do you have ideas or visions before you start to work? Or does it come by inspiration? Or how do you proceed in a new work, a new creation? Well, I have one painting now which interests me very much because it was interrupted near the very end when it logically should be completed, and it's related to another work which I will describe and which, of course, gets close to my creative process. I'm doing a portrait of Joan Cornbley and it has her first name in it, and then I wanted to have the entire name, but it was to be born Clay rather than Cornbley. There's a rearrangement like children's blocks. But what I now have is Chilbourne. And the top half of the painting has nothing at all to do with the bottom. I went away for a week, and when I returned I came back to the painting, and it could very well, the way I'm completing it, it could very well have been completed by someone else. What do you mean by completed by someone else? Because the composition was very vacant in one section. And I've now put two things into it, a reproduction of the mug reed shoes which had toes where the shoes are, and I have added to that a leg going from one shoe, and next to that is a photograph of a young boy sitting in a chair, and the arm of the chair looks like an animal's claw which relates to the toes of the feet. And these two elements have nothing at all to do with Joan Cornbley. And the title of the painting is Jill Bourne, and it's thought of as Miss Cornbley. But I know other people named Jill who've been born. So when you asked me about my being born, to receive in the mail the other day a listing of 25 people named Ray Johnson in Minneapolis, each of them having been born at a different time and each one having a different childhood, I'm not really that important. I mean, all 25 Ray Johnsons should perhaps speak at the same time. I mean, my ideas turn this way. I think we're inclined to think of things to be too important. There's so much unimportance among people. Unimportant things, you mean? Well, theoretically everyone should be interviewed about everything they do. It's like Gertrude Stein said, Americans' big thick books about page after page after page have to say about everything. But it seems to me that you have a very rich eye. Wherever you go, are you always on the alert for visual stimuli? Because in your work, you know, there are so many different things and you must have taken them from so many different sources. I wonder how you perceive them. Well, there are only so many things that can happen within the space of a day or an evening or a week, and I simply live the way I do. I'm interested in things and things that disintegrate or fall apart, things that grow or have additions, things that grow out of things and processes of the way things actually happen to me. The way things happen? The other work I want to describe in relationship to progress is another uncompleted work, which is a portrait of Bruce Nauman, who showed at the Castelli Gallery and was a California artist. I once sent a Brillo box containing small treasures to a California artist, and I received in reply, "You knew the artist?" "Yes, yes. Well, I knew of him through my friend Gerard Hundy, and the exchange for the Brillo box was a photograph of the artist lying on the floor surrounded by the small treasures. He had been photographed after he'd opened the box and investigated the contents. And then quite some time later, I found in a catalog another photograph, a separate photograph of the artist, except that the artist wasn't there, it was just the absence of the artist. And in doing the portrait of Bruce Nauman, I found a small bamboo frame. And in order to write the word bamboo, I could only write a few of the letters. I could never complete the word. It was this inability to complete the statement. I mean, it was like a baby's first word attempting to speak and not really having the experience to say what he wanted to say with the necessary words. So, for a very long time, I felt that the word in this painting was bamboo. And one evening in the subway waiting for a train, I looked down, and on the floor was a small package of cigarette paper with the trademark bamboo, but it was spelled B-A-M-B-U, that is with one less letter. And I suddenly remembered my painting. I had considered all possibilities of the spelling of the word. So I think B-A-M-B-U is better than B-A-M-B-O-O. So the whole point of this is that it has taken me a long time to get the balance of one word in the right place. And that is sort of how I make my works. And that is pretty much the way I live my life. It just takes a very long time to feel comfortable in the way things are composed. Yes, but, in referring to your work, I think there is a great sense of organization, and it's very clear the way that everything is disposed. But what makes it meaningful? It's what makes it meaningful? No, but I say what makes it meaningful? I don't know. I'm asking you. I'm sort of throwing the question back at you. But I would like to ask you this question. Well, I don't know it has to have any meaning. You don't think so? You mean before you do a work you want it to express something? Well, it might be its function to not have meaning. I mean, people might be grasping for meaning, but meaning is not grasping for the people, or grasping for the meaning. Well, there is order in the work, yes. Very much order, yes, I think so. There is a great amount of consideration in planning. And being collages, there are all sorts of possibilities of arrangement, blocks of material get sorted and rearranged. But I think you are much more interested in ideas. I was thinking now of your school of correspondence, for instance, or these happenings that you call nothings. All these things I think are much more. Well, the nothings are now pretty much in the past. I like the idea of nothingness, but having done nothings, I don't have to redo them. I've completed them. But you can tell from your works that they are poetical nothingness, because I feel there is some poetry in your work. The only good poem that I've written lately is my poem to Jack Kerouac. And that was very involved with the process of how it happened to be made, because it wasn't a decision to write the poem, and I didn't take a piece of paper and sit down and compose it and write it. It came about through chopping up something that I had written because I didn't want it to be seen in the state that it was. And the residue was somehow the poem. It made great sense in the arrangement of the lines and what the words said. The lines? Yes. It's a 5-line poem. The poem simply being my next table had to knock. It's all very mysterious to me.
Very mysterious?
It might not be to others. Now could you tell me a little bit about which artists have influenced you most?
Artists who've influenced me most? I think you owe quite a lot to the technique of collage.
Well, there are so many influences I think are really so tenuous that one is influence. I think I'm probably against influences.
Against influences? You mean any kind of influence?
What do you mean by you are against influences?
Well, you're not just influenced by artists. You're influenced by places and years and other people and irritations and problems. There's no direct threat to any one thing.
Do you find, for instance, that it's stimulating for your work to exchange ideas with other artists?
Well, I don't know if it's the artist aspects of the artist that, you know, their personality and whatnot.
Yes. Or what you say to each other.
Is it?
You mean artists who are one's friends?
Yes. Among friends, yes, of course.
Oh, I was going to mention JMG Leclesio because I mentioned him this morning.
Do you know him?
No. He interests me very much because of a photograph. I know him through photographs and have never read him, but the latest novel is what interests me very much, and especially a Time magazine caption reading, Fire and Ice, because the last 3 years of my work has been a long period of ice which was suddenly close to fire and produced a flow of water. And I can see that the flow of water is very difficult to handle and channel because in the ice was really very ideal because of its frozen state and it didn't take very much fire to melt the ice and there are all these forms of water to contend with.
You saw the book in poems or?
In what?
Does it happen to you when you read a book, when you see his book in poems forms?
In poems forms?
Yes. What you mentioned to me last night, you know, about the gathering of the Quaker.
Yes.
And you said that all these people were looking at all these things are for you like forms, and I was very, very surprised by this term.
Well, I don't know how I feel about that today. I think it had very much to do with the position in which we were seated in the arrangement of the people because, in discussing them now away from the place, it's sort of difficult to recapture the vitality of the situation.
Yes, you were very much involved in any moment.
Back to the very beginning of the tape to not be logical every moment.
Every moment?
Should not really go back to one's immediate ancestry but back to the birth of ancestry which takes us right back to the present moment in time. There is a relationship. It is of course of interesting to know people are.
Yes. It helps to understand and especially for an artist to understand his work.
Don't you think so?
I don't know if I really have time to understand my work. I think about it a great deal but.
But you understand it while you are doing it?
Is that it?
Or is it more kind of, you know, you have a vision in your mind or you're under the spell of inspiration? And after you see it you are surprised at what you did?
That can happen.
Well.
Yes. I think that time for you is very important.
You always speak of time. For you is it divided into moments and that you live in the present without your looking back to the past or looking forward to the future?
Can I have a cigarette?
Yes. I didn't know you smoked.
Interruption to have a smoke.
Ray Johnson. By the way, that was the answer to your question about time. It wasn't just on the side. It was the answer to your question.
Machine turned off.
Ray Johnson. You asked about creativity in the process of someone, I think, making drawings, paintings, collages or something like that. You are not working with language, or words or ideas. You're working with things.
Save him face, Chi.
With things, you mean?
Well, with paint or ink, you know. But I happen in my work to use words. And perhaps it's all incorrect that these be looked at in terms of painting or creativity or beauty or whatever. It might very well just be useful objects like an automobile or a chair. And these happen to be things hanging on the wall. And what I wish, well, it would have to be a great interest, would be to try to present what goes into the making of I never used to believe in a work of art being bought.
Why? What did you believe?
I thought it should just be made and not cherished or sold. The things that I'm exhibiting now.
Of course someone comes in and looks at them in the space of 5 minutes and perhaps really that's all the time it should be.
Yes. and then they should be just thrown away or not used anymore. The thing is that one might want to come back a week later and look again. But what happens when you look at your own paintings? Don't you like to see them on the walls? Or you don't want to see them anymore? Something that happened today is that a painting of mine was photographed in a magazine and there were two different Xerox techniques made of the photograph. The painting was never intended to be seen in relation to three other paintings by three other people on the page in the magazine. So seeing it gave it a change of scale, and its relation to these other things gave it a different meaning. If the three other things hadn't been there, if there had just been a blank, it would have been closer to the original work which existed by itself. And the Xerox process changed it. It disintegrated in that I saw it in a way that visually it was not what you wanted it to be. Well, in a way it didn't actually exist to me. I don't understand. Before you said, I understand now when it was space in which nothing is said. Yes. And I think there's great fear of that negation that the spaces in my work are as necessary as the collage elements of the drawings. Yes. But do you think that this space, what you said and what I said, I understand there was nothing in that space? That's very interesting. I experienced, but this is a psychological situation, I experienced that space more pleasingly than the earlier spaces. In the creative process, there are probably moments where something is happening, you have awareness that. Yes. At the beginning of this interview, I felt in that sort of has the boredom of you have an idea. You see a sketch again. Yes. Strive to make this thing into, somewhere along the way, you have some glimpse of the ending, how this will look. It might fail or it might succeed. Because I think that sometimes silence can be much more meaningful than words. Well, incompletion is also very difficult to comprehend. Yes, that's right. One is forever striving to finish, to have a whole experience. I guess it's just natural, but the aesthetic element is probably the realization of how the parts all fit in the composition. It seems to me, I don't know, that any acts you do are very important. I was just thinking of that now, that whenever you do something, you are in the process of doing it. Do you know what I mean? Now you are at the bottom but you feel you can do it. I don't think I make myself understood. You said that maybe what you create has no meaning for you. But don't you think that when you act in life there is? I mean you put yourself very much in what you are doing. And even the words you say when you mention about silence, all these things you feel very strongly. I have not myself invented these things. I've heard other people speak. I have read philosophers and seen other works of art. This has been experienced by different people. But there are very personal moments in doing one's own work that no one else has, I don't think, done. And historically, I remember once I was quite delighted. I was doing very severely geometric paintings based on square units, rectangular and square units, which I methodically filled in with color mosaics. And these paintings took me many, many months to complete. And one day, having this pencil drawing groundwork for a painting, I suddenly thought of putting straight pins through the back of the cardboard into my painting, into the picture. And John Cage was a neighbor of mine. When I was doing it, I rushed over to show him what I was doing. I have this terrific idea to put pins through the middle of every square from the back, and the pins will all stick through. He was quite shocked because I had changed the idea of what it was I was doing. I had made this foundation that I was going to fill in all these colors, and this was to be a painting. And I changed horses in midstream, and I was suddenly going to do something else. And he disapproved. I don't know why. But you are free to do it because it's your own work. Don't you think you can change whatever you want? Well, perhaps I should not have told. Perhaps I should not have been enthusiastic. I mean, maybe what the artist should do is just plow or just sit down and do what you're expected to do, and not come up with brilliant ideas. I thought it was quite terrific. I don't know what John would think of this now. Maybe he would agree that one would not have to just proceed by plans. Do you like what he's doing now in his music? I don't know what he's doing now. I would say I like what he's doing. You're not interested in calligraphy? Not too much, no. I've never studied it. I haven't looked at it much. I'm more interested in handwriting. Well, I guess you would call it calligraphy, but it was on a very small scale. I saw this signature on two different business letters of an administrator, and he signed his name differently, depending on the two people that he was addressing. And the one I saw first interested me very much because the simplification of the name looked like a fishhook and very delicate strokes. If one looked very closely, one could see the pressure into the paper of the pen and the very fine degrees of, well, it was a kind of engraving. It was quite expressive and mysterious. Did you mention my eyes earlier? Were you saying something about my vision, my eyes? The way I see? Yes. I said it seems to me that you have a very rich eye. By that I mean that you are very alert to visual stimulants, or maybe you wouldn't call it stimulants. I don't know what you would call it. But I mean that you are very aware of things surrounding you. Yes. Well, I guess that's natural protectiveness. Protectiveness? Well, like birds. You mentioned also this book of philosophy that you read. Do you read very much? Or? No. Never. Never? Including the New York Times. But you mentioned a book of Lucrezio. Do you read also other books? I read only the section in the magazine. It was very difficult. I think so, yes. Actually, I'm not interested. That requires word-by-word dissection and close examination. I haven't the time. I'm not interested in words. I'm sure you would be very interested in a new novel published in France where each word has a lot of meaning, and they are related to each other and they don't tell a story. You know, it's a little bit like the book of Lucrezio. Yes. But in the words that you put into your work, they all mean something. The whole sentence. Or am I right? In the last show, for instance, you wrote a lot of lines. They all mean something with punch, you know. Yes, the two punch boards. Yes, the punch boards. That I liked very much. But are you interested in words for the sake of words? Well, I'm interested in words in the sense that, as I mentioned before, it was bamboo, a four-letter word which is to a three-letter word in all possible meanings. I'm always rushing to my Webster's Third Dictionary. I told you the story of my show being called Rude Collages, so I took the word rude. I don't understand. Well, in the Village Voice, they list shows that are current. And it said, Ray Johnson's might be called Rude Collages. And I have been criticized in the past that my work is over-refined, too sensitive, just too polished. And the rude must refer to something in the subject matter, which I never thought I was being rude. The subject matter? So that was very mysterious to me, very mysterious. So you rushed. The caption. Because going back to my childhood, I have an uncle who was a twin, and his first name is Rudy, spelled R-U-D-Y, and he's a very strange man who lives in the woods like a hermit and refuses to wear shoes and doesn't see people and is a very strange man. He's an outcast. Does he live in America? Yes, he lives in northern Michigan, where they have snow in the winter up this high. I don't know how he exists. I haven't seen him since I was a child. And he still lives there? Yes, he's a very strange man. Very eccentric. So I had this association of his name to Rude. I thought perhaps since they mentioned my name, and my work, that possibly they were describing my social behavior as criticism of the artist, and not his work. Maybe his rude social manners influence these very delicate collages, casting a rude look on them. So I did a mental inventory of the things, the rude actions in my previous history. I did find instances where things that I have done or said might be considered rude. And do you think they were referring to that when they made the criticism? I don't know. I have no way of knowing. It's very mysterious. I know it will find its way into my work. I was just describing one of my paintings in the show, which is The True Story Ring Globissa, and the second section, where it is repeated, but where it would say, this is Issa, Issa is not there, and where the word is a kind of red blood stains, so the person speaking is suddenly executed, assassinated, and in describing this work to someone, they didn't know that in my book, The Paper Snake, is the original true story and the person in that instance was named Isabel, so the original Isabel, which was simplified to Issa, and then in the next installment, Issa is not there, so it's a diminishing, a chopping off. I understand, yes. So I think in my work I consider every possibility, if it's possible to consider it a possibility, forward and backward. Should something be this size, or should something be that size? And like Mondrian. You use one of his pictures?
Yes.
Mondrian reducing elements to straight lines. Even the very edge of the line is very important, and the blue horizontal snake, which is based on Patricia Johansson's horizontal line. In my case it's wiggly, in hers, it's straight.
Yes.
In mine, it's light and curved, but you'd have to look closely to see the degree of curvature.
The blue snake, you mean?
What I'm trying to say now is, since I do use a lot of sandpaper, each piece must appropriately, I mean all the students' classic proportions. I do work a great deal with rulers measuring. I don't quite calculate the positions. And in the correspondence school I spend a great deal of time filing and organizing material to be mailed, which is more sketchy than the paintings I exhibit. They're apt to be stuck together with scotch tape. The edges are quite glued down.
Now, I'm sorry, Ray, but I didn't really quite understand this school of correspondence.
What?
No, I mean,
I don't know if I believe you.
No, I mean, what is the idea behind it?
What is the idea behind it?
Yes, I understand the process. Not very much. You explained it to me already.
Well, there's the possibility. Well, the idea is that it's a way to convey a message, or a kind of idea to someone which is not verbal. It is not a confrontation of two people. It's an object, which is opened in privacy, probably, and the message is looked at. There are incredible degrees of subtlety of the possibility of interpretation, because two people speaking, such as we are doing here, we can say something, I can say something, you can disagree, I cannot agree with something you say. We can bicker. We can argue. We can try to make our point. But you can't do that when you're confronted with an object.
No, you look at the object and, depending on your degree of interest, it very directly gets across to you what is there, be it visual or object. You know, the most interesting thing is the mouse's ear, which I received in the mail.
The mouse's ear?
A small mouse's ear.
And what was your reaction?
Well, I mean, if you were sitting on a bus and someone suddenly handed you a mouse's ear, you'd think that was very strange, wouldn't you?
Very strange.
You might find it offensive.
No, strange.
Well, it would depend on the manner, and who was handing you the mouse's ear.
Yes.
But to receive this in an envelope neatly packaged and holding it up to the light actually to see what's in it, you get this immediate feeling that there's no explanation. I mean, I'm describing this object without explanation.
Yes, there is no explanation.
Now you cannot experience that in this kind of wall art painting.
You mean?
Well, this column, which is here with the correspondence and everything like that, it doesn't have the psychology of the enclosure in a letter.
You mean that there is in a way more mystery?
Well, it isn't that there's more mystery, but I'm called the master of the art of correspondence. That show the niece of correspondence art. He mentions the blue postcards of Eve Klein, and his exhibiting of my imagined letters that I sent to him.
That you sent to him?
Yes, and also a listing of other artists, George Brecht, Bibi Hendricks, who lives in New York, and other artists who send objects through the mail.
The Fluxus School.
The Fluxus School?
Yes, you don't know the Fluxus School?
No.
They're a group of European and American artists who, well, it's like multiples. They sell editions of things, objects, and, well, it isn't every day that one receives a mouse's ear. But a photograph that you would receive, well, it depends on the interest. I was going to say you'd think more of it than what you might happen to see in a collage. There's never been in New York an exhibition of correspondence art. I don't know how it could be organized, because just to do it would kill it. It would be like involving this natural thing, not that it's so natural.
But, for instance, when you received this mouse's ear, did you send it to somebody else? Or did you keep it?
No, I still have it. I let my doctor take it, but it's still.
I was just thinking of something. Are you attracted by primitive societies, by the fetishist societies? I thought of that when I was looking at your ring, you know, with this dead hand.
Yes, I'm wearing this one because I misplaced my three rings, which I wish,
In fact, I wanted to wear all 8 rings today, but I misplaced these 3. But I'm very interested to read. I think he's a French anthropologist, Levi Strauss.
Oh, yes, yes. Did you read?
I have not read his books, no. But I think I will read. I want to reread a not too interesting book on child psychology called, Which Are Experimental and Teaching Children. I did read one very interesting book on, well, this was, Why Teaching Children? Are you interested in that?
Well, I'm interested in children and ideas.
In the children? Fetishism.
Yes, I think I'm very close to the child's world in my creative process.
In which way? In the spontaneity?
Well, I respond completely to all my instincts and channel them into the work. Never quite get out of childhood. It's very comfortable.
Useful.
Yes, and fetishism attracts you very much also?
I don't know, because if it does, it's probably...
It's the mystery that lies behind all this mask and this.
Well, it's probably very defined.
Yes, but there is something behind the thing which attracts you very much, your imagination.
Well, I was accused recently of performing black magic. I think I told you the story of the man I met who was a witch doctor.
A witch doctor?
Yes. Daniel Spoerry was ill, and a friend brought in a witch doctor to exorcise his evil spirits and everything. He burned candles, and incense, and had bottles of sacred oil, and took convulsions, and rubbed on alcohol or something, and did all sorts of things to cure him.
And you had this doctor?
Well, I was there when this all happened.
Oh, you were there? There were a few people there?
Yes. There were about 8 people for this ceremony, with the witch doctor doing the ceremony. Afterwards, I was sitting on the floor with some colored yarn and was making some kind of an object, which I attached to a doorknob. And then I tried to attach it to this witch doctor's ankle. He was quite frightened. He thought I was trying to get power over him or something. And I don't know why I was doing this. It was purely instinctive to do this.
How did the witch doctor react?
Oh. He wouldn't allow this thing. He ran away. He wouldn't have anything to do with what I was doing. I don't think he understood what I was doing, why I would be tying something to his ankle and to the doorknob. It was completely illogical. And another time, I had so many marvelous times with Daniel when he was in New York. We were at a Christmas party, and I was seated in a chair, and there were many Christmas strings and wrappings. So Daniel began the way a child would do. In fact, I saw a child in the park playing actually put a noose on another child, and I'm sure that one child wanted to hang the other one from a limb, hang this kid by the neck. Well, Daniel began tying me to this chair with these strings and ropes. And I just sat there. There were other people in the room and they watched. It was sort of a joke. And he found some more strings, and quite industriously and seriously was attaching me to this chair. And I couldn't move. I just sat there. And then he placed 2 candles on my hands, on the tops of my hands. I just sat there and the candles slowly burned down and the wax was dripping and, well, it seemed to me to go on for a long time. And we were conversing. And there was a girl there and she suddenly said, I can't stand it anymore. And she rushed over and blew out the 2 candles, because she didn't want the flame to burn down to my skin. And I was very angry. And I said, damn you. You ruined my whole act. I could have got out of here any time I wanted to. And then finally I got cut out of this chair with all the strings tied around me. But part of me knew that I was trapped, but another part of me knew that I could get out of that situation if I wanted to. My will is very strong.
You mean just by blowing out the candles?
But it wasn't that hostile a situation. I mean, I wasn't really. It was just a playful attack on me, I suppose. Because we've had many wild drunken creation periods which involved children's dolls which he attacked and mutilated and pushed around in different ways in a very brutal way.
A kind of happening?
And he had dishes.
Where was it? Was it in Paris? Or?
No, here in New York. And once he came to visit me with a friend, and we sat around drinking rum. And I brought out the chair, which was a... I always have these props that I find. I always have lots of subject matter, unusual things. This was a child's school bench, and it had one wooden arm for writing on. I had painted it white or something. And he started doing something with that arm. Later that evening, He just ruined the whole thing. He turned it upside down and put it backwards. He destroyed the thing that day. And I was very angry. But I thought, well, since I got the idea to take this entire chair apart, so with a screwdriver I dismantled the whole thing. The structure of the chair was very, very complicated. So I put all the parts into a cardboard box, and I delivered it to him at the Chelsea Hotel where he was living. So he received this chair as a gift, which was very funny, because that very same evening the chair, which was a chair like this, suddenly was just all in parts. Completely dismantled. So he made some objects out of his chair. And when the Christos first came to New York, I presented them with a package of forks.
Of forks?
You mean all wrapped? That's a wrapped story because I've told it to you before.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, well, then, that is what I would call a wrapped. It's the beginning of a story where the story suddenly got wrapped and you'll never know what the story is.
I don't understand.
Well, I haven't finished the story of the three or four forks.
Oh, I see.
Because I thought I had told it to you before, but since we have the tape here, I didn't want to bore you by telling the story again, but I don't remember if I did.
No, no, you didn't.
Sorry.
Well, then, I think I'll tell you the story some other time, that specific story about three or four forks.
Okay. Not that I don't want it to be on tape, but I'm keeping Christo's package. This will be a story that suddenly wrapped. But that's an interesting idea of the Christo wrappings.
Yes. I myself for years have made wrappings, but they were always pinned to the unwrappings, because they were just wrappings. I had a marvelous idea today, which is to eventually sell my meetings.
Sell your meetings?
To sell the meetings as a product.
You know, you attended the first meeting. We're planning a second one on May 1st, which I hope will have dance aspects to it. I'd like to ask James Waring to do a special New York Correspondence School dance. And I'd like to have, related to the letters of the paintings, and not such a sober meeting as the one we just had at church. It will be held somewhere else. A bit more expensive.
What do you mean by second meeting?
Oh, well, I had the idea today. I don't know if anyone is interested to buy this, but the first meeting was given freely, you know. I mean there was no
charge.
No, that's how we wanted it to be given. And the second one will be done that way, too. But I would like to come up with some sum of money, like for $1,000 a person can buy a meeting, can buy Ray Johnson, you can buy you, anyone who... You get to purchase 1 month of my organization and my time and my letters. I mean you don't actually get this but it's like a sponsorship. But the idea is I want to sell the phenomenon. It's like the Beatles. They'll just go out on a street corner and sing their songs to whoever is passing by. They are a packaged product. And I also want for the correspondence school for my letters to make just to be put into plastic boxes and sold as objects. Because I think there's a value placed on it which, so that interested me as an experiment. And I always loved Eve Klein selling the empty gallery. So much empty space.
You never did that?
Well, I always wanted to have a show with David Herbert. He had the David Herbert gallery, which is an absolutely empty gallery. But it simply wouldn't pay the rent.
And who has to pay the ransom?
But I think that nothing, it's historical. I don't think it's necessary now.
That's again the same idea of nothingness in a way, by empty space.
Or is it really empty?
Well, what I see is just a traditional.
People acquire my painting and drawings. And so far, the letters are, well, my letters were once put up to auction and they have been sold. I would have preferred they be returned to me or destroyed or something. The Paper Snake Deluxe Edition sells for $12.50. It has original Ray Johnson enclosures in it.
There is a...
It has an envelope in front with one of my small collages in it. That upsets me very much. Because the magic wears off. It gets out of my hands into someone else's hands and I can't really get...
You know, it's part of me, and I can't get that back without my doing something illegal like, so I can't have...
These meetings can be purchased. I can be hired to...
Oh, through them?
Or... No, it would have to be, you'd have to take me just as I am. But like in this interview and talking to me, which I'm very pleased to do, one can get even closer to the creative process through the meeting, the process of the meeting. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with... No, I understand. Of course, I'm doing this as a joke, but I should think someone would be very interested to know what the organization of this whole thing is, and who you can get for $1,000. I mean, there are lots of very interesting people around that can be gotten together in one place if I will sell. And are you going to? This meeting the other night was just the most primitive ways of feeling very humble. Yes. But I can visualize all those people. They are very interested in Art Form Chronicle. But would you be interested yourself to buy somebody else? I don't know. You don't know? What do you mean by buy? Because I think the word buy is very ambiguous. Well, by that I mean when you buy a dozen eggs, I think. You eat them. Well, I think they can build eggs or something. Sometimes you get one with a double yolk or it's rotten or something. But I'll tell you something very interesting. When you buy something... I had dinner in a Chinese restaurant. It was Wakis, and behind that their kitchen, they have a little room. And you can sit in the back, and it's very charming. They have a waiter who shouts and screams and brings you the things to eat that you order. It's a very unusual place. But I was having dinner there the other evening. And there was a big tub on the floor, and the waiter came back there to get. He was sloshing out all this liquid, which apparently was soup stock. But it looked like an old rain barrel. I mean, the way it was sitting on the floor and then these flour bags. Well, it was a Chinese kitchen. It wasn't a Greek kitchen and it wasn't a French kitchen or whatever. It was extraordinarily messy with bags of flour spilled, and you expected to see a rat. But it was that Chinese style of scooping up the soup stock. And we had this marvelous soup. It was very good. But when you're in a restaurant, you know, you think of what's going on in the kitchen. So what is presented to you in a bowl on the table is very different from what's going on in the back. So the purchasing of a meeting, you would get for about 1 month, if one is interested, the whole creative process of the creation, the necessity for the form that it eventually takes, like why did this first meeting have to be in that Quaker church? Sure, in that place in the city. I think it's all very, very personal. I have my own secret about the whole thing. I mean, I have my own very private jokes about this just incredible structure of puns and wit and very witty things of the people and what they do, and who they are, and where they work, and so forth, which was all suggested, but not clear because so many people didn't know the other people. And, although they did meet and converse, it was just the most basic introduction, so they didn't. I, as the artist of it, had this palette, and had gotten those people there, not really knowing what was going to happen. But each meeting would be a different kind of composition, using real live people and what they do. It's very dangerous. It is very dangerous. But let me come back to your idea of, I think it's an interesting idea, if somebody were to buy you, does he have the right to come in whenever he likes and look at the way you work? No, I have all kinds of rules. Oh, you will have rules. They would have to be coded request as to what, I mean, you know, purchasing date and purchasing phenomenon. It's possible that no one could possibly be interested. But the idea itself is interesting. Well, something interesting that came up, the first one having been on April Fool's Day, and having the second one on May 2nd, the fourth one will be on July 4th, which is traditionally America's firecracker time. It's very exhausting to have to think about it. I can't imagine. Do you ever get involved with some happenings? No. Called happenings? Not very much, no. Not really? I was thinking of the happenings of Oldenburg and Capro. No. It is mostly audience participation. And you, or happenings? Well, I think just being there, it depends on the nature or the happening. Jim Dine presented at the Judson Gallery a very unknown work. I don't think maybe you ever saw it. No. Rainbow Thoughts. Washington Gallery. A room construction with a door, and you went through the door and found yourself in black space. And there was one very tiny light bulb which went off, on, off, on. And above the light bulb was a piece of cardboard with rainbow colors, so that all that you saw was the light on the rainbow and the light bulb. You could stay there as long as you wanted to. And you left. That's all it was. I was with a friend of mine. We were in there for about half a minute. And as we were leaving, the light bulb had that switch, and she turned it off. So that the next person who walked in would walk into this little black room where nothing would be happening. I thought she was very witty to do that. Because, for the whole day, there was one girl sitting at the desk. She probably never went in there, because it was very boring. She probably... the light bulb. And it was probably purchased as a new light bulb, so that it wasn't apt to burn out. But it implied the possibility of being turned off, because any child would have had the impulse to do that. And if he had not had that switch there, the girl might then have had the impulse to steal the rainbow cardboard two things. It's hard to know. Well, I thank you. I think we'll stop here. Is that it? End of interview. This transcript is in the public domain and may be used without permission. Quotes and excerpts must be cited as follows. Oral History Interview with Ray Johnson, 1968 April 17, Archives of American Art, Smithsonian Institution. This audio version was produced in 2014 by Greg.org.